This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Recently, I have visited a few neuro ICUs and have seen opportunities for early mobility to support delirium management and transform patient outcomes. Today, I bring Rosa Harden to share with us the role delirium can play in the outcomes of stroke survivor. Rosa, welcome to the podcast. Can you introduce yourself to us?
Yes, thank you so much for having me today, Kaylee. And my name is Rosa Hart. I am the stroke nurse navigator for a large system in our area. And at this point, my role is to call stroke survivors after they've been discharged from one of our hospitals with an ischemic stroke. And when I call them, I talk to them about their medications, about their modifiable risk factors like blood sugar, blood pressure, cholesterol, things like that, and identify and help them find solutions to the things that they're struggling with to prevent stroke, but also to have the best quality of life that they can after having a stroke.
So you've built up a really unique expertise on survivorship, stroke survivorship, right? And many of these survivors have left the ICU, so they are also ICU survivors. And I want you to mention as well what the project is that you're working on right now.
I am building a podcast for my system that I work for. It's called Stronger After Stroke. The first episodes aired May 1st. So we already have 8 episodes out, ranging from topics of sex after stroke to stroke survivor stories, as well as hearing from our experts in neuromusic therapy and migraine and how that relates to stroke, as well as gender roles and what that can look like when you can no longer perform the gender role that you found your identity in once you have a stroke. If your abilities change, like how does a person find value in kind of helping them think through that in the course of those conversations?
Which is amazing. And I recommend that people share this podcast with their survivors as they leave the hospital, with the families. What a great resource. And even for ICU clinicians, I have always felt, and this is a focus I've taken throughout this podcast, is that if we understood what survivorship looked like, it would influence how we care for them in the initial phases of critical illness. So now with your expertise, with all that you've seen and experienced, why do you feel the ABCDF bundle is so important for stroke victims?
Survivors.
Stroke survivors.
Stroke survivors, right? If they're a victim, then I don't get to talk to them.
But even when, I guess, if we're looking at zooming in on, you have this big picture, you see the other side of it, but if we're rewinding, going back into the ICU and zooming in on that immediate moment when they roll in our doors, what do you wish that maybe you had understood as you cared for them in those moments, or that clinicians now understanding survivorship?
So I'll share some of my story with you, because I think it really, my growth and understanding of this topic, while there are elements that I did not understand until listening to your podcast about the effect of sedation causing delirium, that really blew my mind and had to me rethinking some things about my experience. But my experience with ICU started in 2013 when I was working as a nurse aide, and I started in the neuro ICU. I think that was a really good thing, because as I learned, a lot of people are afraid of neuro because they don't understand it. And I didn't know to be afraid of it. So I was just like, these are the patients I'm working with, people who have strokes. So initially I was assisting the nurses who were caring for them while they were doing their NIHs, and they were inserting their Dobhoff tubes and all that. That's part of the acute care phase of taking care of stroke patients in the ICU. And, or I was holding them down as they were trying to escape, you know?
So yeah, it's a tricky population.
It really is. We would joke that sometimes people think that neuro means crazy. And so people that were not appropriate, but no. So as I came from being a nurse aide to working as an RN on those same units, I was working night shift, and night shift in the ICU at a facility that cares for a whole lot of patients was very demanding on this staff who were responsible for their life and death, right? And so we had a lot of patients who were unfortunately snowed on sedation. And I really want to highlight the fact that I feel like that was the choice of the lesser of two evils in a lot of situations, because we had to keep them alive. And we might have this decompensating patient over here that it takes almost everybody on the unit to work collaboratively to keep them alive. And then we need to keep our other patients sedated so they don't take out their life support while we're not watching, right? So I felt like there was a lot of moral distress on the part of the educated nurses who were trying to teach us to minimize sedation and have those awakening trials. And I did receive a lot of education about that when I was working night shift, but it was really hard for that to be the priority when the priority had to be keeping somebody alive as well, you know? So
as many as patients were not likely to be oriented, calm, compliant.
Right. Especially not initially. Like, we're going to talk about the ABCDEF bundle, and there's so much human interaction required in order to implement that bundle. And if you don't have the human power to do it, if you don't have those safe staffing ratios, it's not physically possible to do that ideal care. And so I just want to put a plug out there for safe staffing for retention of nurses.
This is one of the biggest cards to play, right? It's like, where are we increasing mortality, long-term disability, suffering because we don't have enough people to sit at the bedside and hold their hand?
Yeah. And
we're kicking family out at night. So we're taking away our resources, and we're not providing resources and so it's almost like these staffing ratios expect you to snow your patients.
Yes.
And that's a huge problem. And I love that you bring up the moral distress, because once you do know the price to be paid with these medications, and yet you're in the situation when you have so many fires going on, and if you have impulsive people trying to pull out their lines in a neuro setting, that may not just be delirium.
Yeah.
But then you can add delirium on top of that. That's not what you want to do. But then you're trying to keep these life-saving devices and interventions in place. You also have hard exceptions like intracranial hypertension.
Yes.
Where there is no other choice but to deeply sedate them. But then once that's done, it's hard to take it off because now you've got likely some delirium and agitation going on. So yeah, I think neuro has a lot of really difficult exceptions. And yet the ADF bundle is still so important. Like, you still, especially these are vulnerable patients that are coming to you with brain injuries. Mm-hmm. They're high risk of poor outcomes. So why is this so important to still focus on?
So I got to transfer to a day shift position at a different hospital that was a comprehensive stroke center. And since we were receiving stroke patients from all across the region, we would get people in who had already received Alteplase, the clot busting medication for acute onset of stroke, as well as we were able to serve patients with a mechanical thrombectomy or that surgery to pull the clot out of their brain. Mm-hmm. And So when you're serving this very specific population, you have to staff appropriately to do their Q15 neuro checks and their every hour NIHs for 1 to 2 days, which are extensive neuro exams that have to be completed. So in that scenario, I would enter this whole new world, I felt like, of people being able to provide the level of care that I had thought was not possible. I remember being oriented and I was like, yeah, but we don't have time to do that, right? And they're like, oh no, we make time. And then we have a relief nurse who will come and make sure that it gets done. And just having that level of support to empower us to implement the ABCDEF bundle was just mind blowing that it could really be real. So, you know, I'm sure you talk about it on this podcast so much all the time that everybody listening knows what it is, but I'll just go through A for assessing, preventing, and managing pain. Well, if it's a stroke patient, you don't get to give them morphine, because you don't get to give them any kind of sedating medication. You need them to be optimally alert so that they can perform this neuro check so that you know their neuro status. And sometimes that causes pain. So, and that's just part of it. It's like, well, if you're feeling pain, that means you know you're alive. I'm really sorry. But like, that was a huge shift in thinking that in becoming a neuro nurse, was that sometimes things you do for people can cause them pain, but it's for their own good. And that intention makes the difference. But also non-pharmacological pain interventions, such as distraction in between assessments and relaxation and repositioning is not just something you do every 2 hours to say, oh, I repositioned my patient, but it really is, that is their pain relief. That is how you can provide them with some relief from all the discomfort that they are going to be experiencing. And music therapy was something that I saw as a pain intervention. So we had a neuro-specialized music therapist who would come in and find out what their favorite music was and teach them and the family to play it around meal times. So they would have that familiar stimuli that would elicit those feelings of comfort, but and also help them stay awake during the day. And then we would keep it quiet at night so they could sleep, to help them in the midst of us not letting them sleep for 2 hours consecutively for a very long time.
Right.
Be able to tell when it was day versus night. And so spontaneous awakening and breathing trials were not so much of an issue because we were not knocking them out. That was a big learning curve for me when I come in and so many patients are on Precedex, not propofol, because we need them to be able to do their neuro assessment and they can do that on Precedex. And so that was a new thought for me. And then learned a lot about we don't need to give Seroquel for people to sleep in that situation. And that's an antipsychotic, not a sleep aid.
Yeah.
Right. So if they're not psychotic, we don't need to be giving that to them. Just a huge learning curve for all of these meds that I thought routinely had been prescribed for people who were coming from nursing homes, who were taking this every night, you know, at baseline. And so I thought that's just what you give people who have trouble.
Oh, absolutely. When it's so normal, especially when you've started your career learning those things, I don't think we really question it. Mm-hmm. I started my career in Awake and Walk in ICU, but I appreciate that even years after when I went to other ICUs, I didn't ask as many questions as I should have because it was so normal. Mm-hmm. You don't question it, but we equate normalcy with benign. Mm-hmm. If it's always done, if that's what everyone's doing, it must be fine. It must not be harmful. We wouldn't even imagine that we could be damaging patients with something that everyone is doing.
Yeah.
So then it is a shock to go into a new environment and say, oh, so what I was doing before, what I was taught before wasn't necessary or wasn't maybe helpful. It's a shock.
Well, and you do need, like we said, that empowerment to allow that ideal standard of care.
Right.
So in my former environment, I did feel like it was necessary in mm-hmm. order to keep the most people alive as we could at the time.
Right? Because of the way that the unit was staffed, with it was structured, you didn't have the support to practice at a higher level.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So there was a lot of, So changing environments mm-hmm. was really enlightening for me. For delirium assessment, we were neuro assessing our patients so much. I don't know if I remember independently. I don't think we had to assess for delirium separately because we were just assessing them all the time. So we did a delirium assessment like with our neuro assessment. But inattention, with so many people already having like ADD and stuff, that part of the assessment for delirium, I felt like was so unfair. Like for Save a Heart, I'm like, how are they going to squeeze this crap? Like who passes this?
When they pass it, you feel pretty confident they don't have it, right?
Yeah.
For the most part. But it is important to continue on beyond the times four, right? To say, because delirium can be so variable, so elusive.
Yeah.
And why are you, what risk factors do stroke patients carry for delirium?
So I had to talk to one of our neurologists about this because when you and I were discussing doing this episode, I tried to do some research and I didn't feel like there was a whole lot of research specifically on delirium risk for stroke patients. And he said that it was really hard to differentiate if it's the ICU causing the delirium or if stroke is just one more burden on their reserve in like maybe they have COPD or maybe they have some other kind of comorbidity that's already depleting any of their reserve mental faculties. And stroke is one more insult that adds to the burden, putting them at a higher risk for delirium. So honestly, in the course of preparing to talk to you about this, I felt more and more confident that our standard of care that we give to our stroke patients is really good information for other specialties because we have learned, well, they had to be awake for this. And this is an awake and walking ICU. When I first came there, I was orienting and a patient walked by me on a vent with PT and OT on either side and respiratory pushing the vent behind them. And I was like, what is happening? I said, who let them do that?
Stop. This is scary. This is dangerous.
Yeah. And so I will never forget the level of shock that I experienced seeing that for the first time. And not every patient will qualify, but that was just really inspiring. And so being in that environment, seeing that it was possible, really made an impact on how I care for patients.
And your value of neuro exams and cognitive function is extremely exemplary for other specialties.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
my first contract, leaving that awake and walking ICU and then going to a quote normal ICU, I remember that first shift wanting to do a neuro exam. Like that was part of my ingrained habit, right? Because most of my patients before had been awake and that was just, it's part of your head to toe assessment, nursing 101, yeah. Right? And then I couldn't do it. And that was one of my first concerns was, well, why can't I do it? Why are they sedated, right? That was one of the triggering questions. One of the things that triggered that question as to why they were sedated. It was, well, then how do I do a neuro exam?
Exactly.
And looking back, I should have been more concerned. And I especially should have been concerned that no one else was concerned. Like a neuro exam was not a priority. It was, well, they're on a ventilator. Therefore, we can't do a neuro exam. Now, three contracts later, I was in a facility that was practicing some level of the ABCDF bundle, and I was being taught how to do an awakening trial. And I was told to turn sedation down just enough to see them thrash, then turn it back on. And that was, again, I wondered.
Initial training too.
That was in your initial training too? Yeah. And I don't think any of us have anything to be ashamed of, right? These roots are deeper than us, right?
Yeah.
And deeper than those nurses that trained us. This is one of the problems, is that's how we've been trained. But I remember being really confused because one, I was pretty confident that agitation was not just the ventilator, as they'd said, because I had seen so many patients be calm and compliant on the ventilator. And two, yeah. I remember wondering, but how do I do a neuro exam? Or what is that? That doesn't tell me anything about their neuro status. But no one else seemed concerned. No one else was asking those questions. And so unfortunately, I didn't have the confidence to say, wait a minute, nursing 101, we should be doing neuro exams. So then it's amazing to think how many patients go how long without neuro exams. And so we saw during COVID, mm-hmm. many patients had strokes and cardiovascular events because that went undetected.
Yeah.
And then now we're doing CT scans and MRIs after weeks of sedation because we don't know. We don't know why they won't wake up. Was it the sedation? Is it delirium? Is it a stroke? We have no idea. So how do you as a neuro nurse feel about patients going days to weeks without real neuro exams?
Now, having seen the difference, I 100% understand how it can happen because I lived yep. in ICU environment, but also I've seen that you can keep your patients awake safely, but you do need to make choices, like to minimize the invasive equipment that's attached to them that's limiting them, right? So how many patients are sedated because you don't want to mess up their A-line?
Well, you can.
Do they need an A-line?
Right.
Because in my old ICU, they thought everybody needed an A-line.
No. One of the results of minimizing sedation is a decrease in infection. And I think one of the reasons is because we minimize those devices.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have Foley, central lines, A lines, all these things mm-hmm. as long when sedation is minimized.
Exactly.
We naturally progress them.
Mm-hmm. And they don't need a dot cough tube if they can get extubated. And usually, right. Well, that was another thing with stroke patients, specifically if they come in and are being worked up for stroke, everybody gets a Torbest, which is a swallowing exam. Nobody gets anything by mouth, no sips of water, no nothing, unless you have a Torbest to clear you to swallow. And then if you don't follow or don't pass the Torbest, you have to have a barium swallow study with a speech therapist. And any meds that have to be administered before then, you have to have a Dabhoff tube or it has to be a suppository. And that was very strictly adhered mm-hmm. to. But that's another invasive thing that's really hard to do with somebody who's awake. So,
but yeah. The standard of care, you're making sure that there's no dysphagia and your patients are, you know, obviously at higher risk of dysphagia than most.
Yes, definitely.
And when you're talking about delirium, we've been talking about the immediate in the ICU. But why are you concerned about delirium now with your perspective of survivorship?
So stroke survivors, we have learned, have a lot of anxiety and depression after the stroke, whether or not they experienced a debilitating injury that caused them disability. And a lot of that can be fear that they're going to have another stroke because they understood what happened to them. And that's a real possibility. So it's fear based in reality. Mm-hmm. And then you have fear of not knowing what in the world is going on. So for my stroke survivors, I feel like it's really important for us to learn as much as we can from those who are able to share their experience, because there are so many whose communication is impacted, who may be experiencing the ICU delirium you're talking about, but the language center of their brain is not allowing them to communicate it.
Yeah.
So I'm so thankful for the stories you shared of those stroke survivors or those ICU delirium survivors who got to share how terrified they were and how confused they were, and how it's like sometimes they would know that what they were seeing wasn't real, but they couldn't tell what was real. And it was because of their sedation. And we do have a lot of, like you were saying, the intracranial hemorrhages and hemorrhagic strokes that require more sedation. They have more surgical interventions that get involved. And so I was really hearing potentially their voices and their experiences, especially if they were not able to ever verbalize that.
I'm thinking back to, I took a contract in a neuro ICU, and I'm thinking about these patients that are impulsive. They pull out lines. They're really a lot of work. It's stressful. And this is before I really valued delirium. And I'm thinking of a patient that was on heparin drip. He'd had stroke. You know, that one side that still works gets busy. And he wasn't my patient, but I wanted to check on him because he was Spanish speaking and I speak Spanish. And he had his Foley catheter in his hand, balloon still inflated while he's on a heparin drip, and there's blood everywhere. And I just, I can hear my own voice going, "Ay, no, Juanito, que te hiciste," you know, it was just this big panic. Now I'm thinking, you know, replaying that in my mind, did Juan have delirium, right? I was just thinking it was just the stroke, or it's just, you know, it's an ICU patient, so they're confused, but did he have delirium? What was he really experiencing? Was that a snake that he thought when he pulled it? You know, what was really going on? And I wish that we looked at ICU patients like we did stroke patients, because we're seeing a stroke patient and we're thinking, we've got a long-term big picture here. This could change their entire life, the trajectory of their life and their family, the career. We have to really hurry up with rehab. We want to give them as much cognitive function as possible because they're already under attack. And yet, so we do have the stroke going on. Their cognitive function is at risk. But delirium adds another insult to it. So you can have delirium on top of stroke.
Yeah.
And their cognitive outcomes are much worse. So I wish that throughout all the other specialties, another take home, right, for the rest of the specialties is to think about the brain. No matter why they're in the ICU, we need to look at it the same way, that their cognitive function is at risk. No matter why you're in the ICU, you've got a long-term impairment looming over your head unless we take action.
And we had one benefit of having standing orders for PTOT and speech therapy assessments for stroke patients that are not, I don't know that that's the standard for everyone, right? And so if you're not doing a neuro assessment and saying, oh, their cognition seems off, we should have OT or speech come and give them a cognitive eval, they can be discharged without ever anyone picking up on that. And I feel like with our stroke patients, because we do have that standing order, because that's part of the best care you give to stroke patients, is setting them up for success with rehab. If it's home health therapy, outpatient therapy, or acute rehab, we have a protocol for that. And we can pick up on those cognitive deficits and have that conversation with the patient and the family in the room, in the hospital, where you're like, well, you may not be able to do basic math and drive yourself safely and all this. And those can be hard conversations to have when you're talking to the head of the household who can't hear any correction from anybody, but you have the evidence right there in front of you, right? And if you send somebody home without having all that set up beforehand, it can be, they may never get it in their life. They may be out there on the road driving around with an anoxic brain injury and nobody knows, because they didn't have a head CT, because they didn't have a stroke. So I think having our stroke protocols really is a protective factor for our stroke survivors, because they do get those brain scans and they do identify those injured areas and those areas that need support.
And your rehab specialists are not visiting the ICU. They're in the ICU. They are the ICU team.
Yeah.
And that's something to also replicate in the other ICUs, that those rehab specialists should be an intricate part of the assessment, the planning, the intervention. But a lot of times in the other specialties, because we don't think the brain is really relevant, or we think the physical function is going to be a secondary back end thing, they just get to visit every once in a while if a patient's not on a ventilator. And we don't have those conversations with delirium survivors. We don't say, you've had an insult to your brain. This may change the rest of your life. Let's set you up with resources to help you rehabilitate at home. So that's another way to replicate what we do in the neuro ICU. But how great that you have a safety net for delirium victims as well as stroke patients.
Yeah. And so I've been really encouraged in the course of preparing to have this conversation with you, because I've realized how many great protective processes we have to help with delirium.
And because you already have those specialists in play, you know, maybe they're focused on the brain, but no physical therapist is just going to focus on the brain. They're going to look at the whole body. And so you've already got protective measures against ICU acquired weakness. If you already have physical deficits or changes from the stroke, they're working on that right away, because the sooner you work on it, the better the outcomes. And so ICU acquired weakness is probably quickly prevented and addressed.
Oh, yes. We have multidisciplinary rounds every morning at 9:45, Monday through Friday. I don't think they do that on the weekends yet. That would be great. But everybody's got room to improve, right?
Right.
As far as ICU acquired weakness, as opposed to the weakness that would have already been caused by whatever their stroke had impacted. So if they come in with a large vessel occlusion and one side of their body is not working, and then they get alteplase, and then they get a mechanical thrombectomy and revascularize that area, it may take some time for that side to reanimate, basically, for them to regain strength in that affected side. But one thing that we're working on piloting right now is early mobility after alteplase, because the guideline has been that for patients who got alteplase, known as TPA, they can't get up out of bed for 24 hours afterwards. So they have to use a bedpan, or bless their hearts, the men who have to stand to urinate, they get straight cathed, bless their hearts, which, tell me how straight cathing a man with an enlarged prostate is less of a bleeding risk than him standing at the bedside.
But if you don't ask why not, what if?
Exactly. So I'm so thankful we're trialing this to hopefully decrease the amount of time patients are made immobile after alteplase administration, because that mobility is so important for retraining that affected side to wake up and move again.
Right. And preserving the side that's not affected.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you want full mobility, you've got to have at least one strong side to support the other side. But when we leave patients in bed, we don't give them that chance to preserve whatever they do have.
Exactly.
One nurse that I worked with, she's done this for nearing 40 years now. She was one of my mentors in the Wake and Walk in ICU. I've always idolized the kind of nurse that she is. And she splits her time between that medical surgical ICU and neuro ICU. So here she is walking patients in multi-organ failure, ARDS, high ventilator settings on ventilators. And then in her neuro ICU, they think that she's absolutely insane for getting her patients up to a chair. So I asked her when I started the podcast to come on and talk about that. And even just mentioning that, she was in tears.
Oh,
it is so painful for her, so sensitive. And I think that's why she continues in that ICU, because she knows that if she's not there, those patients won't move. And she's one of the most hardcore, passionate people about early mobility that I could see in the med surg ICU. I mean, there's no way she's taking no for an answer. And she always says the best thing for her patients. And I know she's that same way in the neuro ICU, but that wasn't always shared. So it's just interesting. I'm just imagining now exploring this with you. This is why she's so passionate, because your patients are so vulnerable and need that kind of support.
Yeah, definitely.
Not just in that moment, but their whole lives depend on it, because they've already come in with so many risk factors for an altered quality of life after the ICU. And we can easily add to that, or we can support them to have the best chance possible. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about your podcast. How do you recommend that our ICU clinicians that are listening to this podcast, how can they use your podcast to support stroke survivors?
So I've really created this podcast as a tool to be used for free anywhere there is internet access. And every single episode has been designed as a 20-minute gold nugget of relatable information for pretty much anybody who's experienced stroke. So I believe anyone who works in the ICU, especially those who, like, you see frequent flyers come in again and again, and you see, like, the social determinants of health are not giving them that safety net that will allow them to stay out of the hospital. They need so much support, whether it's mental health care that's not covered by insurance, or they don't have the transportation to get to their doctor appointments, or they don't have that follow-up care, or they don't get their medications refilled. There's so many social determinants of health and that place people at a higher risk of a stroke reoccurrence. Before talking about the podcast, I really have to talk about the resource center that I work at. So in this neuroscience resource center, it's not just me. I'm like the only stroke-centered person, but we also have social workers, and we have program directors who have free neuro yoga, Tai Chi, and Feldenkrais classes, brain games, which is a free class taught by a speech therapist, a vestibular support group taught by a neuro PT. I lead two stroke survivor support groups that are virtual and in person. And I'm saying this because I think there needs to be more places like this that provide that support, where, like, our social workers will help people make sure their medications get paid for and filled. Mm. And get transportation to those follow-up appointments, whether that's like through a gas card for somebody who's giving them a ride, or helping them sign up for TARC 3. And I really feel like that is so core to that preventative care that gives people a good quality of life. And this is the Stronger After Stroke podcast is just another program that we're offering for free, not just our patients, but expanding that reach to anyone who's had a stroke or cares about somebody who has a stroke, so that they can have access to the neuro-specialized information. The headache specialist that I get to interview about migraine and stroke, he was like president of the American Headache Society. Okay, like, there's a 6-month wait list to get in to see them to get the question answered. Well, how do I know if I'm having a stroke versus experiencing a migraine? Should I be calling 911 and getting these thousands of dollars of charges that are not covered because it's not a stroke? Or and he gets to answer those questions.
Wow.
And so the value in each episode is, I feel, priceless. And I don't think I'm overstating that, because
absolutely.
Providing access to care
and validation for your survivors. They feel like they're not alone. Their concerns are valid, real, and that there are answers and support. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing, Rosa. And I will put a link to your podcast in the show notes so that everyone can check it out, and especially share it with their patients and the families.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for all you're doing. And we'll keep learning from each other. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Let's go. schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.